This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We'll not only continue our series of programs where we're chatting with some of the best-known and most accomplished American composers, but today we conclude our visit with one of the most sought-after and certainly one of the most recorded living composers, Richard Daniel Poor. Born in New York City of Persian-Jewish descent, he studied at the Oberlin Conservatory and the New England Conservatory of Music, and then later at the Juilliard School. He now teaches at both the Manhattan School of Music and the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. His teachers included Vincent Persichetti and Peter Menon, and a working relationship with Leonard Bernstein. His career is lettered with a long list of accomplishments, including Grammy Awards. He is one of only three composers, after Stravinsky and Copland, to be signed to an exclusive recording contract on the Sony Classical label. From one of those Sony discs, you just heard the first movement, Musica Verna, from his Anima Mundi, Spirit of the World, the four movements of the work being evocations of the four seasons connected with phases of human psyche. David Zinman led the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. My guest has been commissioned by many top international classical musicians, including such names as Yo-Yo Ma, Jesse Norman, Don Upshaw, Emmanuel Axe, Thomas Hampson, and the Emerson and Guarneri string quartets, plus major orchestras and festivals. Even his singular operatic effort, Margaret Garner, written with Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, was a success. He has a recent recording of his works on a continuing series on the Naxos label. This week, we'll turn to music for the voice. And before we chat, we'll hear the final movement from his symphonic song cycle, A Woman's Life, on text of Maya Angelou from 2007. This movement, called Many and More, soprano Angela Brown performs with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra, led by Giancarlo Guerra. Text. You're not a composer that shies away from setting text. Some composers still do. How do texts get on your radar that like scream out that they need you to do something with them?
And that's another great question. See, I'm the kind of person who I invest in a text. And by that, I mean, I don't see something and then set it right away. I see something and I think, oh, that's really great. I need to learn it and I need to have it assimilate into my own cell structure so that it becomes truly a part of me. And then maybe a decade later, you know, I'll be ready to set it. So I read things that I know I won't set for at least another 7 years. It's like wine. It's like buying wine.
Yeah.
You know, the Yeats cycle that I did with that famous poem, The Second Coming. I read The Second Coming when I was still a doctoral student at Juilliard. And I thought, wow, I got to do this one day. But I knew I was nowhere near emotionally or in any other way ready to write it. So, you know, I didn't start writing this until I was 46.
A lot of pieces where you set text are dramatic. However, it's what, now 11 years since Margaret Garner. Only the, well, that one foray into opera, very successful. I know I've had other composers tell me about, you know, it's either you love it and continue it, or you hated the experience and put it at an arm's length. What's the deal with opera?
See, I've always believed this. I'm really, at least the way I've looked at it now that I've had some time to look at my life, my working life, I think I'm really a kind of a theater composer, even in my concert work.
Yeah.
You know, I've written a lot of secret operas. People have asked me what the structure of my works are, and for years I lied about it because I didn't know how to explain to them that the real structure of the work was a kind of dramatic scenario, the dramatic scena that I'd concocted in my head. Now, one that I actually spoke about openly for the first time was when I wrote my first cello concerto, which was for Yo-Yo and later recorded with Yo-Yo Ma and the Philly Orchestra on Sony. That's a piece where I had a dream about this oracle who had come to speak to an assembly, and, you know, the news was not good, and they started having a sort of questioning the oracle and arguing amongst themselves, and finally when they asked the oracle to, you know, explain by what authority he was coming and telling them these things, he spoke to them very, very plainly, and, you know, in my dream there was this sort of sound from heaven that sort of gave its approbation, you know, approval, and they couldn't handle it anymore, and they sentenced him to death, which is the point at which I woke up from the dream, and then I continued the dream in the piece.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing was very normal for me. I've never really written pieces that were just like pure abstract concert music pieces, like,
no,
for instance, like Brahms.
Yeah.
You know, even though, like Brahms, I'm very much a kind of a classicist in my structures. But in terms of outflow of the work and the ideas that engender the work itself, you know, I'm much more like a Berlioz in that sense. I have to have this other thing going on.
But will there be another opera? Or was the experience of doing it? I mean, I've had composers be on both ends. I mean, years ago, John Harpson said Gatsby was like, ugh. And then other composers, you know, Paul Morvick has gone on and he's embraced it and he loves doing it.
It's hard to do it. And what I don't want to do, see, there are a lot of really good composers for the theater who are not necessarily great composers, you know, but the works work for the theater. If I'm going to write an opera, I don't want it to flop. Mm. You know, I want it to work, and it's one of the reasons why you haven't seen another one. I want to make sure that if I do this, that it's like the planets lining up. It's so hard to make sure that every single thing that's going to ensure the success of the work happens. It's very difficult to pull off. But I am working on something now which is sort of right in between an oratorio and an opera. It's kind of like the way Oedipus Rex is, you know. And that's probably a signal that the work after that I do, which I have a real treatment for, a full-length evening, is also coming because I'm starting to think about it now again.
Can you give more info on what you're working on now?
Absolutely. Those contracts have just been signed, and I spent most of the summer putting together the libretto myself as well as writing the short score of the piece. I was at Yaddo in Saratoga Springs for 36 days, in which I managed to get 11 of the 14 short scenes written into a very detailed short score, and the last three scenes are very rough and they need to be copied out. But what it is a passion oratorio that's in Hebrew and English. What I decided I wanted to do was take the story of the last 24 hours of Jesus' life and bring it back to its Jewish origins. And in doing so, also include a lot of those messianic prophecies that exist in Isaiah, and some which are sort of associated, you know, with being messianic prophecies from the Psalms. And I also wanted to do this with a very strong perspective of the women, because you see the two Marys in the story, they're like a force field. You know, you feel their presence periodically, but you never really get to hear from them. There's maybe in the course of all the four Gospels that, you know, are part of the canon of four Gospels, you hear maybe a handful of words coming out of their mouths.
Well, Mary, you have the Mary the Mother, you have the Magnificat.
And after that, there's very
little. Magdalene, just the resurrection story, which is at the grave.
Correct.
Yeah.
You got it. Exactly.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to do was all the commentaries. The St. Matthew Passion was the piece that made me decide that writing music was kind of like where I wanted to be in my life. By the time I was 15, I heard it then. And that was the piece that sort of did it for me, you know, that tipped me over the edge in that way, that made me decide that that's what my life would probably be if I had made a decision at all, you know, in this. So I designed the piece with a similar structure, you know, three huge choruses, chorales in part one and part two, but the commentaries are all mezzo-soprano and soprano commentaries. They're all female. And, you know, they're either from the Tanakh, or there's a section which uses the Passover ritual, and there's, you know, it's all kinds of stuff. But I've wanted to do this for many, many years. In fact, it was the thing I was going to do right after Margaret Garner. And then what happened was Mel Gibson came out with that movie, and I didn't want to be associated with anything having to do with Mel Gibson.
Right. Yeah,
and so I thought, let's just wait another decade. If I'm still alive...
you are a long time prayer.
You know, if I'm still alive, I can write it, you know? Yeah. And so... it was just at this time, last September.
Yeah.
I'd just gotten back from being away in the summer, and I'd finished a piece that was a collaboration with my friend, Erica Jong, the writer, and it's just going to be premiered at Carnegie this December. And I thought, you know, I woke up one morning and I said, you know what? I'm not going to wait around. I'm going to make this happen myself. And so it was one of the very few times that I actually created the commission by assembling all the people together. Huh. And I raised half the money of it myself just to do it, because I knew that, you know, getting older is a funny way of propelling you into doing the things you really need to do. So that's what I'll be working on this now for the next, probably for the next year.
Yeah, and said as a complete compliment, but it's one of the perks you have for being how successful you've been. I mean, to be able to do that, not many composers would be able to pull that together. Just as a side note, rest his soul, but years and years ago, I had Gunther Schuller as a guest.
And
he had just conducted the St. Matthew Passion, so he just went off on his tangent that it's the first piece of modern music, and he went on to explain how and why.
He's right.
It's amazing to
hear him
talk about it. You know?
He's right.
Yeah.
You know, that chorale, it's the last of the Passion chorales that is sung right at the moment after Jesus expires on the cross. It's in the Phrygian mode. You know this chorale? It's extraordinary because the dissonances, the way he loads up with these extraordinary dissonances, and the fact that it's in the Phrygian mode, you know, it's unlike any other chorale he ever wrote. I mean, I was so taken with that chorale for most of my life that I even wrote a piano fantasy based on that chorale, in which the piano fantasy is really a set of variations with the theme coming at the end, which is the chorale, note for note. And you don't realize it's a set of variations until you get to the end. Then you think, oh my God, I've been hearing variations on this the whole time.
My guest teaches at the Manhattan School of Music and the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Here is Curtis student Adrian Kramer, baritone, president of Curtis, violist Roberto Diaz, and head of the Curtis Opera Department, Mikael Eliason, in the world premiere performance of Come Up From the Fields, Father, words by Walt Whitman, music by my guest today, Richard Daniel Poor.
Thank you.
last thing.
Sure.
You teach at Manhattan School of Music, Curtis Institute of Music. You're very instrumental in restructuring those composition departments, but you still teach. So I like to ask composers this, why and what do you get from that younger generation? What does teaching give you?
You know, I did not really want to do this at first. It was not something that was a choice. What I think started to happen in my 30s was I saw so many composition teachers who were leaving their students hanging out to dry. I saw some who were downright abusive to their students. I saw others who were just basically there for the paycheck. And I thought, wait a minute, this is not right. You know, these kids need help. Some of them are very, very talented. And so when I was invited to teach at the Manhattan School, I thought, well, I'll try this and see if it works. And then I realized, you know, that I actually was able to be helpful. I was useful. You know, I remember hearing many, many years ago that, you know, if somebody asks you for something and you know you can help, and you don't help, it's a sin.
Yeah.
So, you know, I realized that this is something that I kind of fell into partly because I saw that I was needed. And I originally had thought that what I would probably do to supplement my income as a composer originally was to conduct. But I started to realize as the years went by in my 30s and later that it was physically exhausting for me to do that and write music at the same time. This was an easier way to be helped, because I think conducting is a kind of teaching. Mm. I'm sure that Gunther would have attested
to that
too. It's a form of teaching, you know. But for me, it came as a result of my feeling originally, just realizing I could be useful, and I could be useful in a way that was not somehow depleting my ability to write. In fact, it's the other way around. I think that I'm only as useful as I am as a teacher because I'm one of those people who writes music year-round. If I wasn't, I think I probably wouldn't know what to say to them, because I've got to be in that zone of being involved in the creative process to be able to get inside theirs. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, not that. Yeah. Well, keep it going, keep it coming. The passion sounds fascinating.
That's something we really, I mean, you know, of all the projects that I've discussed with Naxos over the years, this is the one that I really, really want to have them do with Joanne and Buffalo Phil. This is the big kahuna so far.
Gerard Schwartz leads the Seattle Symphony in the final movement, My Hero Bears His Nerves, from the 1990 work by my guest Richard Danielpour, The Awakened Heart. Thank you.
close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, somebody never had a chance to, what's the first name that pops into your head? Don't think about it too long.
Probably my father.
It'd be fine.
Who I lost when I was 21.
Oh, okay. So you don't have a lot of bank of memory there.
You know, my father had MS when I was, you know, he was diagnosed when I was 8 years old. So he gradually was disintegrating while I was becoming stronger. I felt in a way I had only a minimal kind of contact with him. But what I did know of him and what the contact I did have of him was that he was just such an extraordinary man. He was just incredibly kind beyond, you know, good and just a natural grace and goodness. And I would have loved to have just, I would give anything just to have dinner with him for one night, you know.
Over the 11 years, of course, you know, boxing, number one answer, but people are always, very few people pick family members. So there has happened before, but it's very
There are lots of composers. You know what? Who I would say would be the one musician I would love to sit down with would be John Lennon. I'm not as interested in, you know, these sitting and talking with these great composers, because from everything I know about them, the best of them was revealed in their work.
Yeah.
But from what I know, because I know a lot of people who knew John Lennon personally, and they told me that when he was sober and not drinking, he was actually very, very funny, and he was just a lot of fun to hang out with.
His humor always came out.
He was hilarious. Very biting.
Very biting.
But very, very funny.
Very
funny,
yeah.
There was a guy, and this is something that Alan Parsons had mentioned, you know, to me. I did a course when I was visiting at UCLA on words and music, and we spent the last 2 weeks talking about the Lennon and McCartney catalog, which to me is really arguably the classical music of popular music in the second half of the 20th century. And there was a guy, and I interviewed Alan on FaceTime. He was like the second engineer for the last two Beatles albums, you know. But I don't know whether it came up through him originally, but I talked about it. There was a guy in the very early days of Abbey Road by the name of Norman Smith. And he was one of those, like, very straight-laced guys who wore the white lab coats, you know, in EMI. And John Lennon's nick, he had nicknames for everybody, but his nickname for Norman Smith was Normal. You know, and that's just, it's typical.
I mean, he's the right in a Monty Python sketch with the
lab
coat on.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, I would say, apart from being able to just hang out with my father, I would have loved to have spent some time with John Lennon.
Well, I think one of the stranger stories, and I think it's true, is that John Cage lived in the same building, and when Lennon was being stalked by the CIA, his phone was tapped.
And Bank Street, correct.
John Cage would take his calls for weird that Cage never turned that into a piece, but anyway.
There was a wonderful moment, you know, when I was getting my doctorate in the 80s, I taught little kids piano at the Dakota, and I lived right behind the Dakota, so when I would have my lessons with Mr. Bernstein, I would literally walk across the street whenever I had a piece finished, and we would listen to the score, and he would make his comments, but I also made these house calls to the children of these very wealthy families in the Dakota, and I taught the children of Albert Maysles, the filmmaker, and Al was a wonderful guy. He just passed away a couple of years ago, and his son, who I think has now become an architect, his son Philip was one of the students I had, right? And one day I'm standing, and this was on the first floor. They lived, like, on the first floor, right underneath the Bernstein apartment, which was on the second floor. Lauren Bacall was on the third floor, and the Lennons were, like, on the seventh floor, right on the top, right? So I'm standing there, and all of a sudden, this is like 1984, okay? Little Sean Lennon walks up to the elevator with his Beetle Bob haircut and the round glasses, and he looks at me and he says, "You're Philip's piano teacher, aren't you?" And I said, "That's right." And he said, "You know, I'm playing piano too. We play our pieces for each other." He starts rattling off all these little John Thompson pieces he's playing. I said, "That's great. I'm waiting for the door to open." He's waiting for the elevator. Silence. And he looks at me. He walks a little bit toward me and he says, "You're a composer, aren't you?" I said, "Yep, that's right." And he says, "You know, my father was a composer." It was heartbreaking. I said, "Yes, I know."
Hey.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. Final question is a non-musical question. Everybody sure. I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy. But when you have to step away, get a little distance, respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do? It takes you away from music if you need to get away. Clear your head.
I mean, you know, I like whenever possible. I just like, you know, doing fun things with my wife, with Kathleen. But just in terms of if I actually had a hobby, you know, it would either be watching film, which I love. I love watching films. I'm the kind of person who likes watching the same film over and over many times just to, like, you know, see it from a different angle. Actually, the funny story is that, you know, like, I love Godfather, the first two of the Godfathers. And if ever I decide to, like, pop it in and see it again, screen it again, you know, my wife hears the theme song from the other room and I'll hear this, oh my God, oh no, not again. You know, but I also love baseball. Yeah. You know, I'm just a, you know, diehard baseball fan. And it goes back to those early days of, you know, those ball players were really like my first mentors, you know.
So you dropped this. Who were you bat boy for?
Atlanta Braves.
The Braves. Okay.
Yeah, in the days of Henry Aaron.
In the days of Hank Aaron.
So, yeah, in fact, we invited, when I wrote the piece called Pastime that Atlanta Symphony premiered and Pittsburgh later did, Andrew Young, who I'd gotten to know through Maya Angelou, was instrumental in getting Mr. Aaron to the premiere. Yeah. And, you know, it was the first time I'd seen him in about 34 years. This is 2007 now. And it was great because, you know, one of these five movements is really about the history of the game, but it's really about also the evolution of the civil rights movement through the funnel of the game. You know, there was one poem that the poet who did this with me, Michael Harper, had written about Aaron. And I said, you know, this is just my way of thanking you for, you know, you were one of the first people outside my family who showed me what being a man in the best case scenario was supposed to be like.
Yeah.
It was great just to have that reconnection with him. He's a wonderful guy, you know. And they came to the premiere of Margaret Garner when City Opera did it in 2007.
Cool.
They were there.
That's very
nice.
Anyway, thanks for taking some time.
You're so welcome.
Composer Richard Danielpour. You can find out more about him at his website, richarddanielpour.com. The recent recordings of his works are on the Naxos label, found at naxos.com. And I'll leave you, from one of those Naxos discs, with a musical portrait of his current home and his birthplace, New York City. Once again, the Nashville Symphony, conducted by Giancarlo Guerrero, performs the work titled Toward a Splendid City. Music by my guest today, Richard Danielpour. As always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and at WWFM.org.
We'll be right back.